720 WGN. Thanks for staying up late with us, everybody. 2:08 in the morning. That song by the Red Hot Chili Peppers is called Snow. So Jess is sticking it to me now. Kim Bellweck is in studio with us, joining us on the air right now. I was complaining because Roger said in the forecast there is rain and some snow tomorrow.
But it's supposed to be nice by Sunday.
Not till Monday, I think. Oh. Roger, you want to give us a quick update on that?
Sunny on Sunday but and a high near 48. So it should all be melted away and dried off.
Yeah, but
it'll be good painting weather.
I don't know about that. 48's a little rough, but Monday it's going to get up to like 55, 58. Right?
58, and so mostly
that's going to seem gorgeous. We'll be wearing shorts on Monday.
Well, speak for yourself.
Well, okay. Well, I've got the legs for it. I'm sorry. Kim Bellweck is in studio for us. Who are you writing now for, Kim? Who do I say? You're writing a little bit for everybody right now, right?
Well, first of all, I love that you always give my Twitter name a shout out.
Yes. Did I just call you Kim Bellweck? At Kim Bellware is in studio with us. Her Twitter handle is at Bellwack because it's the first like five letters of her name and then her first initial.
Yes, you remembered.
But you know what? I was thinking about it earlier today. I'm like, I always tease her about it. Why is she Bellwack? And then I figured out. But why did you not just do your whole name and then Kim and K?
It was because back when Twitter had a shorter character limit and back in the day, they included your handle as part of the characters, so you had 140 characters minus the length of your name,
so you would keep it
a shorter name. Was yeah, that
so
was
the R and the E got robbed out of your
yeah.
But did you like the way, because it kind of sounded like Bellwack?
Yeah, I figured I was like, it's short enough, and no, you know, it was available.
Was Bellware K taken?
No, luckily every Bellware in the world is family, and none of them are on Twitter.
Are there no other Bellwares you've ever found in the world?
I have a cousin in New York who is on Twitter, but nobody else is. My brother is a lurker, but he really goes, I think, just to
see what other people are writing.
Yeah.
That's okay.
So, yeah, most recent story was for Vice about the youth reaction in Chicago to the Jason Van Dyke verdict, and I have some work forthcoming that I did about elections with City Bureau, the Civic Journalism Lab, which just celebrated its third anniversary yesterday with its annual soapbox ball, and Chicago Magazine, still doing things there, have some work forthcoming. Also had something out about the new do-gooders, so I profiled a few people and organizations, Appalachian, Recipe for Change, and all of a sudden I'm blanking on the third one, which is
okay.
Terrible.
That's a lot. No, you're working a lot for a lot of different people, I imagine.
Yeah.
So I saw you tweeted about the governor's race and the mayoral race this week, so I wanted to bring you in and talk to you about that. But let me ask you about the Jason Van Dyke trial, because I had a client coming to town that Friday. I was picking him up at Midway and then drove into the city. And actually, it was kind of right downtown as the buses were leaving the courtroom and stuff. We listened to the verdict live here on WGN Radio, and it was kind of a crazy time. And it was interesting because the city was really prepared for a lot of craziness and protests and possibly violent protests to happen. It seemed like there were a lot of police on duty and a lot of talk about, and there were some stories afterwards, or some talk on Twitter and things like that about, is the city perpetuating something by preparing so heavily as if a group of people will protest or riot or burn the city down if they don't like the verdict?
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting way to look at things, like, well, is it the city's responsibility to be ready for that or be prepared in some way, or are we creating a self-fulfilling prophecy if we do that?
I think it's a really fascinating and important thing to discuss. So strap in, listeners. I think a lot of things are true at once. It is not something that is, you know, there are no neat narratives in Chicago. I talk to middle-aged, you know, older folks on the West Side, black residents who were truly terrified of not expecting, you know, violent protests or anything, but very, very worried of the prospect because they lived through the riots that devastated their neighborhoods, which had not come back.
Yeah.
In other cases, I think there was probably a lot of fear and stuff that's not always very well placed. And something, I mean, I guess I like have to kind of put the white folks in the audience on blast for this, but something that it came up during the Serena Williams issue with the U.S. Open a while ago. And there was a Australian cartoonist who drew a caricature of her. It was like very racist. And he defended it as, you know, this is how she looks. She's just so big and, you know, she's just so muscular. And someone pulled up a photo of her side by side with, you know, her competitor. And she really isn't that much bigger. She's like only a little bit taller, like maybe a little bit, you know, more muscly. And someone said, you know, in this case, like the black woman of a white person's imagination is never as bad, is never what they think it of their imagination, is never reality. And I think that's kind of true, too, because there was a lot of, you know, bracing for, you know, violence, for unrest. I think people accurately knew that there was a lot riding on this verdict. There was a lot at stake, and it was extremely emotional. But a lot of people, I would single out Natalie Moore at WBEZ, who, you know, does a lot of reporting on the South Side. You know, she noted that the city hasn't had a riot in 50 years. When the videotape was released in 2015, all of the protests, while intense, were peaceful.
Yeah.
You know, there were the arrests were the kind of things that you see for any kind of demonstration, you know, trespassing and minor things like that. On the other hand, if you are the mayor, if you are the, you know, police superintendent, and you underprepared and something does go wrong, then you are just, you know, they already have enough problems going on. They wouldn't need a, you know, a PR disaster like that. So, I mean, I don't know what the best way to manage that would be, but I think that that point that you made about maybe perpetuating it, I've seen that at protests a lot where, you know, the presence of police out in such force, especially
when they're protesting police.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's what it's about, then the presence of police, while necessary, possibly in some way, just because people are walking through the streets, it does come off that way, whether it's intentional or not. That just is a little tinder to the fire.
I will say, to the CPD's credit, you know, they were mostly in uniform, some were in plain clothes, a lot of bike patrol, a lot of foot patrol. Much better and much less, you know, not ratcheting up the intensity if you had them, you know, compared to if you had them
shields
in
and helmets,
shields. Yeah. You know, that would have been just, that would have been bad. So I think, I mean, all things considered, you know, it was peaceful. The protests, you know, were for, you know, solidarity and to call attention to the issue. But it was also very different. I was outside the courthouse when the verdict came down.
Mm-hmm.
And people I know who were covering outside City Hall, where there was, I think, a larger cluster of people, you know, very different. Outside of the courthouse, I was actually surprised at how muted the reaction was. I was expecting this explosion, you know, like jubilation. And I think one of the reasons that didn't happen is because at the end of the day, if you were on the side of hoping for a conviction, it doesn't change the calculus that Laquan McDonald is still dead.
Yeah.
You know, what are you celebrating? And that was kind of what I got at with my story with Vice when I was talking to the teens, because a lot of Chicago's youth have been working and organizing with, you know, restorative justice. And they're very against the, you know, kind of prison system and criminal justice system as it exists. So on the one hand, they want accountability for police, but on the other hand, they admitted, some of them said, it was really hard because rooting for Jason Van Dyke to go to jail means that we're also rooting for a system that we have acknowledged is broken and isn't good for anybody. So a lot of complexity there.
You know, I wonder, with the muted reaction, I think it was also very difficult to figure out exactly what was going on as it was being announced.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very complicated reading of,
and
you
it was
know,
long.
First the judge is explaining, you know, second degree does not mean it's lesser. It's just, you know, and he explains that. And then they start reading, and then they're reading on every count on the 16 shots. And so I'm like, you know, a minute in, I'm like, wait a minute, did they say guilty on the first shot? Because maybe they, you know, and the guy in the car is like, yeah, they said guilty on everyone. So as you're listening to it, you're kind of like trying to figure out exactly what is going on here. And then what does all this mean? You know, will he for sure get sentenced? Or do these run concurrently? Like, how does this all work? So I think it was kind of hard to figure out exactly. You knew he was guilty. And so there was, you know, it's weird because there was relief for me, like, as like I felt that, you know, this is what the verdict should be. But I think I was also relieved that, okay, the city will be fine. And
yeah.
So that's this. And is that, you know, it's interesting. So here I am, this white guy who grew up in the suburbs, and I'm not around a lot of black people. And, you know, whether we want to admit it or not, there is, I wouldn't say inherent racism, but there is an inherent fear of each other, I think. There is. That's just out there.
That is one of the biggest problems of segregation in our city, is that, you know, your imagination is always going to fill in the blanks. If your neighbors, if the people you encounter in where you go grocery shopping or where your kids go to school, if your neighbors aren't different than you, your mind has to fill in the blanks of like what they must be feeling, what they must be, you know, how they must be reacting. So it's so apparent whenever I go someplace else and come back to Chicago, it's like, this really is a... We really messed this up.
Do you really feel like this city is way more segregated than other places you go to?
If I go to someplace like New York especially, mm-hmm. I mean, even in my hometown.
New York is almost like one I feel like we got to throw out of the mix.
Yeah, like an outlier.
It's really the melting pot of the world. I mean, everything just, but like, let's talk about LA and Atlanta and like compare. I feel like then we'd have more of a, okay, how do we really measure up against other major metropolitans?
I don't know. I still feel it though. And I think some of it, it's as simple as, like, you know, if you ride the red line, you really see how stark these divides are. I mean, who's getting on, who's getting off, I think that should be a good Chicago 101 for anybody, whether you were born here, you just moved here, ride the red line from Howard to the Dan Ryan and get a full sense of like how the city is north to south.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's very true. Let me ask you about the protests that were going on during the trial.
Yeah.
I thought that was very interesting because here we have the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, in a sense, this is where justice happens. And whether or not Van Dyke would be found guilty, he faced a trial. There was a prosecution. There was a defense. But when there were people protesting during the trial, I was kind of like, it's very interesting because I understand they want justice, but and maybe it's just viewed as the system is flawed because most of the times in major cities, we've seen this with many other cases where the police officer is not found guilty, and then there is a great deal of anger about it. But I was thinking about it like, you know, this is the justice part, and we have to get to a point where when it gets to trial, we kind of accept what happens. I didn't pay enough attention during it, and I think the city and Rahm got very lucky in the fact that there was so much else going on nationally during this trial that took the heat off of Chicago. What was the makeup of the jury?
So that was one of the really big contentious things. So during jury selection, the jury had one black juror on it. It was the one thing that's kind of awkward is that, you know, reporters were not able to talk to the jurors. Mm-hmm. So there was something, I was talking to Patrick Smith at WBEZ, who was covering the trial, and he admitted there's something kind of gross about having to guess people's, you know, race by just appearance.
Right.
But the jury was overwhelmingly white. There were a few, I can't remember exactly, but there was a few Latinos and I think one Asian person on the jury and one black juror. And Cook County is just slightly whiter than the city as a whole, where it's roughly a third white, a third black, a third Latino. In Cook County, you know, where the jury pool is drawn from, it's a little closer to maybe 25% rather than a third. Mm-hmm. But I was talking to a friend at the state appellate's office, a state appellate lawyer, and he said that's actually pretty common. Black jurors, black men in particular, are really underrepresented in jury pools, and a lot of that has to do with voting registration, permanent address, who's incarcerated, things like that. So we can see the impacts even of incarceration rates of certain groups. Like, those people are not part of juries.
Yeah It's interesting because I didn't know the makeup of the jury, and I thought, well, there would have been a fair argument that, boy, this was not a really representative jury then, was it? But if it would have been, say, three or four African-American people and then what a good cross-section of the city, and then he would have come back not guilty, how would we then justify, if we were very upset about it, would we say that's BS? How could they have done that? Or would we say, okay, this is a representative of the city, and they sat and listened to it all, and they had their reason to come. You know, I wonder how we would have digested that.
I think people would have zeroed in on who the holdouts were, because it only takes one, to not get that guilty verdict.
Yeah.
I just had such a strong sense. I mean, because I was following this case just on top of it. I was at court some days, but doing a lot of watching from home. And I think everybody did a great job. You know, all the local reporters did so well covering this. But it just didn't look good for him from the beginning. I think there was a huge emotional hurdle to get over. I just remember when the counts were, the charges were read, someone audibly gasped in the courtroom because they go through and they say, you know, one count aggravated assault. You know, they do that 16 times. Yeah. And we felt that again when they read the verdict, how long it takes to get through 16 counts. I mean, that alone was just like, ugh, like that seems like an uphill climb. And then, you know, one of the biggest things in, you know, in any self-defense trial, which was, you know, the Van Dyke team's argument was that he acted in self-defense. Juries really want to hear from the defendant themselves if they're claiming self-defense.
Right.
And I think there had, what I had heard is that there was hesitation to put Van Dyke on the stand because he wasn't testing well.
Yeah.
And he didn't end up, his testimony did not do him any favors.
Yeah.
He didn't come off as particularly, I think, sympathetic and forthcoming. And, you know, I think that ultimately had you know, role to play too.
Now, because I didn't pay enough attention to it, I only caught bits and pieces. How did the defense try to present it? Because in my mind, the problem is shots 15, you know, 2 through 15. I've always argued that, and I didn't follow closely enough, so I don't know everything with it. And I've heard that he said things as they were pulling up that were very damning, like, I'm sick of this crap and, and things like that. But if you watch, I feel like if he would have shot once, even if Laquan would have died, I don't think we have this trial.
Yeah.
I think none of this ends up happening. It's the fact that he just keeps shooting.
Yeah.
And so how did they present that? Did they try to defend just the one shot? Because I only heard the verdict and read just a little bit about it at the time. But how did they try to defend that?
The defense really went in really trying to, you know, kind of dirty up the victim. Make it look like McDonald was...
I did read a lot of headlines that they put Laquan McDonald on
trial. I mean, that was very difficult for a lot of people, too. Like, they were happy with the verdict, but one of the things that was difficult for them is seeing how, you know, this kid who's dead is, you know, his whole... You know, the worst parts of him are brought out, and, you know, even the way the special video that the defense created to show what was, you know, purportedly Van Dyke's
viewpoint
that was not captured in the dash cam. You know, they made him like in all black, and you know, in the closing arguments, you know, his defense attorney talked about him as like a monster and trying to get them to envision, you know, the horror movie music. And it just, I'm not surprised that worked. But the main argument of the defense was that they brought in a lot of police experts who could speak to what they hoped would be, you know, convincing testimony on the state of mind of a police officer, given their training, given the situations that they're in, you know, for example, trying to get the jury to understand how quickly somebody who is 30 feet away from you can close the distance if they're running.
Right.
And if they're armed, why that does, you know, why that would credibly pose a threat to somebody, why someone would feel that their, you know, life is at risk. So they really tried to get into the tactical, you know, this is the mindset. But I think, like you mentioned, a lot of the comments that Van Dyke made, you know, saying, like, when he got the call saying, like, well, we're gonna have to shoot this guy, I think that was really damning. Also the fact that nobody else drew their weapons.
Yeah.
And there was a Cook County sheriff's deputy who did, you know, also arrived on the scene, and he testified, you know, for the prosecution, saying, like, I didn't draw my weapon because I didn't see the need.
Yeah.
So I think the defense really was, this is a cop who is just doing his job. He is trained to do this. This is how they react. And then, you know, there's other kind of things too, like, you know, their sense of time and perception is different because of the adrenaline. And, you know, the jury wasn't buying it.
So that all goes to shot one, in my mind. That everything you just said were arguments for shot one. What did they say about 2 through 16?
They were trying to argue, you know, with, you know, Van Dyke saying what his perspective was, which was different, was that, you know, first however many shots, he was still moving. It looked like he was getting up again. The fact that he didn't let go of the knife after he was on the ground, he still posed a threat. So, I mean, again, when you say it out loud, it's like, of course a jury didn't buy this.
Yeah.
But the there was a lot of, I think, just kind of, he didn't come off as a credible witness, but he was saying, he even said of the tape that was made in his defense, that doesn't show my whole point of view. And so he kind of undermined his own defense.
Well, and I thought, one thing I did hear that I thought was interesting was when he said how he was coming, I thought he was coming at me.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, this clearly shows he wasn't. He's like, that's not what I felt at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And I could see that as an actual, like, listen, when you're out there, we can watch tapes all day long. When I've got a perpetrator with a weapon and I have a gun and we're in the real life situation, maybe, you know, as I see it now, I see that he wasn't, but it felt to me like this person, and I imagine for all police officers and the heightened everything like that, we can't understand it even by watching video.
And I think that's what they were trying to get them inside of, like, you know, you could understand unless you are in the situation, so take our expert testimony word for it. I think the other thing is that the defense and the prosecution never agreed on the shots, as in, you know, there was an agreement that there were 16 fired, mm-hmm. but there wasn't an agreement of, because even the medical examiner was inconclusive of which shot was fatal.
Right.
In some ways, he partially died because he bled out. Mm-hmm. You know, if he'd only been shot once and it didn't get an artery, he maybe could have been saved, even if it were maybe a more critical wound.
Right.
But, you know, there wasn't any accord as to, you know, did shot number three, was that the one that was like the fatal one, and the rest kept coming. So there was, that's also where everybody was kind of trying to make their argument, which was, you know, I didn't know that the threat was neutralized until like shot 16, whereas other, you know, people said he was down after shot one.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone's just trying to argue, you know, their facts and their perspective. And at the end of the day, the jury didn't buy what the defense was putting down.
Journalist Kim Bellware is in studio with us. You can follow her on Twitter at Bellwack. Quick break, and then we're going to do the news, and then let's talk about, spanning out of this, the mayoral race and the gubernatorial race. Next, here on 720 WGN. This is Snowblind by Styx. I saw the texter asking for this. Now the texters are giving me a hard time and trying to think of snow-related bumps to give me a hard time about my whining about the idea of snow before Halloween. Kim, wouldn't you agree that there should not be snow for Halloween? Shouldn't the kids not have to trudge around the neighborhoods with snow boots on in their costumes?
I absolutely agree, but like, also as a, you know, Midwest native who trick-or-treated with layers of clothing and gloves.
But
you
it
know.
Sucked!
It
Is
does,
that a
it
fond
did
memory
suck.
Of your childhood?
No, I was like the chubbiest ninja / ghost / pioneer girl / night sky. I got very conceptual in third grade.
Boy, you're going to go year by year. You can name every costume you ever
I love
did.
Halloween. It's the only thing like standing between us and Christmas coming into stores in August.
That is true. So what are you going as this year?
I, for the past 4 years, have done a buddy costume with my dog. And
aww.
Everything has to be like pretty low stress on her, you know, no colors,
sure.
no
yes.
silly hats. So
why no colors?
I mean, like as in coloring her fur or something like that.
Okay.
This year I have ordered a nice Detroit Red Wings patch, and I'm making her a vintage Gordie Howe jersey because she's going to be Cameron to my Ferris Bueller.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to top our Han Solo and Chewbacca or our Scooby-Doo and Velma, but, you know, we've got some good
well,
ones.
You put some effort into this.
I love Halloween and I love my dog, so, you know.
Very impressive. But now, so you're not going to parties and bars or things like that because you're not bringing your dog. This is just neighborhood trick-or-treating?
Oh, no, I am going to parties. When I went as Han Solo and she was my Chewbacca, one of the guys at the party I went to, it was a house party, was dressed as a Thanksgiving turkey. And she is a, you know, pit mix, about 55 pounds, and she's very friendly, and she loves, like, jumping and licking and saying hi to people. So she jumps up on this excited turkey man, and the costume is like this gold lame. It has mesh at the top where the head of a turkey would be, and that's like where your eyes are, and then the bottom has the little frilly little frilly cuffs. And so I have these photos of a 6 foot tall turkey man and like a dog, you know, just
trying to
get the turkey. So it was very full circle.
Jess, did you want to ask something of Kim?
If I may.
Yes.
First of all, Kim, I really just want to be best friends with you because my dog also has a Chewbacca costume.
Oh.
And I'm very excited. And my dog is now too fat that she does not fit in the costume anymore. So I am going to donate the Chewbacca costume.
Okay, well, wait. Let me ask you both. What is the Chewbacca costume consist of? Because our dog, his middle name is Chewie because he is named after We debated over Bailey and Chewie, and Bailey won. But he's Chewie because I think he looks like Chewbacca a little bit, and I think all he needs is like the belt. All I want to put on him is the Chewbacca belt.
I made like the little bandolier for my dog.
Oh my god!
Because she's a brindle, a brindle color. But like, it was a good costume. I even bought the Han Solo blaster, which that year I went was a year that one of the Star Wars movies came out, and those were so hard to get. I was angry at myself that I was paying.
Waited
you know,
too long.
I probably may or may not have paid a $25 overnight shipping for this stupid thing, so I could paint it black. And I mean, I have a on principle, I do not want to spend more than, you know, like $40 on materials for costumes. Sure. So that was a hard one, but you know.
Jess, what does your Chewbacca costume consist of?
It's just a really, it looks like a furry bear, sorta.
Okay, so it is.
I've seen those, yeah. Because you have a smaller dog, right?
No, I have two big dogs. I have an 85-pound Burmese Mountain Dog named Sally.
Oh my god.
She's a little fat for the costume.
Don't you just make those dogs go as Beethoven every year and you put the little
barrel underneath them?
What is in the barrel? Is it rum or like medicine?
Roger, you would know this. Roger, in the olden days when they used to rescue people on the mountains with the Burmese Mountain Dog with the barrel under their chin, what was in the barrel?
It was a liquid imbibement.
Yeah, but was it rum or was it like vodka?
It would warm you up. In that weather, it wouldn't be so hot.
Right. Or were there ever really dogs with these, or is that just cartoons we remember?
I think it's just cartoons. Because if the dog is running around in the snow with a barrel and someone's following it, I bet you the person following it probably has a bigger barrel.
Maybe.
And would be able to take care of any people trapped in the snow.
But I'll tell you what, if you had your big dog and you went around, because it's like in our neighborhood, we live, you know, out in the burbs, and all the parents walking around with their kids, the parents generally all have a little something with them as they're walking around. So if you had your dog with a barrel and he could, you know, you say hi to people, hey, do you want to
fill up everybody's drink?
Yeah. You'd be the toast of the town.
I always think that my dog needs to do more to earn her keep, and if she can carry my drinks for me, then, you know, that'll go a long way.
Hey, Matt.
Yes.
I saw on Facebook earlier today that Mark Shipper dressed up his dog as a UPS man.
I saw that, too.
Those are very cute costumes.
I like when you see the dogs playing hockey where there's a costume where it looks like they have arms in front, so when they run, they're like have hockey sticks and helmets on and all that good stuff.
Yeah, the UPS one that I've seen is like that because they're carrying a little parcel.
Carrying a package.
Yeah, which I wanted to dress my dog as that for our UPS guy, but just for him because he is the nicest, best UPS man.
That's when you know you're getting out of control, when you are buying specific costumes. Like you'd have eight, you'd end up with 8 to 10 costumes for Alex. He's like, well, the UPS man, I got to do this. But then, you know, when we see the lady who walks down the street with the Dalmatian, if you're a Dalmatian for her, that would be really cute. And then you know that like you're in trouble.
But he's always interested in the ridiculous things that I buy. So, yeah. You know?
The UPS man is?
Yeah.
I think he's hitting on you.
No. He's very, it's very dad-like. It's a very, you know, it's a very respectful.
A very respectful
delivery.
You what
know?
You getting here, Kim?
He was more just like, sometimes you can see what it is. I remember I got an inflatable kayak one year because I've always wanted to kayak on the river, but the shells are very expensive and I don't have anywhere to store them.
Yeah.
So you can get an inflatable kayak. They're surprisingly affordable, even for a freelancer bum like me. And so when he delivered it, he was like, what is this? And I was like, it's an inflatable kayak. And he was like, tell me more. So I'm an inflatable kayak evangelist.
I don't know that I would get in an inflatable kayak on the river.
It sounds.
Kayaks make me nervous.
Oh, because they're so tippy?
Well, it's just like the one person sitting in the thing, right?
Mine is a two-person kayak.
But are you, the way I picture a kayak is like where the body's coming out, but you're kind of surrounded by kayak. It's not like open completely, right?
Mine is
sort of like you get in it, and your legs are kind of in it, but it's.
Yeah. No,
I think there's a claustrophobia thing for me with those.
Where you're too enclosed.
A little bit like it makes me nervous because I'm going to fall over and then I'm stuck in this thing.
There might be a difference between like a kayak, like a skull or like a sculling shell and like a kayaking shell.
Is it completely open generally? Like just a boat?
I think kayaks are a lot more open or like it's more of like a capsule shape that you get in and it's not the kind of thing where you're. It's not like the movie The River
more
Wild.
Of a racing thing where they're in the thing and they're, you know, racing
where,
all the
like,
time.
Where like your lap is covered. Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, this is not that.
But it's something that could pop at any time.
It is.
And that would freak me out too.
Well, this is probably not going to inspire a lot of confidence in people, but it's an Intex kayak. If you want to sponsor Matt's show, please do that. It's Intex, and I know them from inflatable kayaks, but they're the big inflatable mattress and like camping mattress company. So they do know a thing about.
Because I have an inflatable. I have two inflatable mattresses.
But I think it might not inspire confidence because every single inflatable mattress that my family and I have ever owned has always popped. So you know what, though? I've had that kayak and I've taken it on Lake Michigan. I've taken it on the Chicago River.
You've taken an inflatable kayak on Lake Michigan.
Yeah, you stay close to the shoreline. I take it on the Michigan side, not the Chicago side.
Okay.
I feel perfectly safe in it. You're not riding rapids in that.
I suppose not, but still, I don't know. It makes me nervous. But that's really cool.
I'll take you out. I've got another seat.
Yeah. We would end up, I guarantee I guarantee you we end up under the water if that happens.
That will not happen.
How do I even get into it? Especially an inflatable one.
Wait,
how are we both getting in this without going over?
We're going to have to take a quick tangent into the wide, wonderful world of Chicago's park spaces. Of the many things that you can do for free in Chicago, there are various, what they called, put-in points. Not a lot of them, but there are different put-in points that are free and open to the public around town. So one of them is at, I don't remember the name of the park, but it's the one up on like Rockwell and Belmont.
Okay.
Around there. And you go and it's just that you step down to the dock, and the dock is only maybe 10 inches, a foot above the water line. And you put your kayak in the water and one person hangs on to it while you get in, and then you hold on to the dock while your partner gets in, and then you're off. But I have really been on a, you know, kind of real high with all the great stuff in Chicago, because this summer, in addition to kayaking around, sometimes illegally at private put-in points, because I'm not paying for someone using the waterfront, which is for all of us. Did you know that you can take free archery lessons in this great little hidden spot, like in Belmont Harbor? There is an archery range. Someone who built that park on the waterfront designed an archery range, and it is beautiful, and it is really fun, and it was legitimately the most weird, lovely, diverse group of people I have ever seen in my life, all doing archery.
And it's free?
And it's free.
Arrows and the whole deal.
Yeah, Lincoln Park Archery Club.
That's really cool.
Yeah, once a month. I mean, I think it ends in October, but in the spring and summer, once a month, they have a free clinic, and you can go and learn how to do this. And
all right, back to your inflatable kayak. so you go to these put-in points. Are there any, like, have you ever come down here? Because like, it'd be incredible to do right here on the river by the big buildings and, like, just kind of hanging out and seeing all that.
Yes.
You have done that.
I have.
You have one paddle that you're kind of working back and forth with to move you around?
I have a buddy with me.
Oh, you always go tandem?
Yeah. I just don't know how the weight would be. I mean, it would be fine, I think, if I had one, because the seat, I guess, cockpit, you would say, is one big open pit, and the seats are...
Are you side by side or are you front and back?
We're front and back, and the seats are inflatable, and they have buckles that buckle into the side, and that's what keeps them in place. And then they have like Velcro on the bottom to keep them from slipping around. But I thought it was crazy, but I thought worst come to worst, I can just return it if it was a nightmare. And it was really sturdy. It's comfortable.
And you have a air thing that you blow it up with, right? Because it would take forever to...
Yeah, and I bring it with me. It's faster to blow it up than it is to deflate it. There's two chambers, one in kind of the floor and then one in the sort of bumper that goes around you. I think I can get that thing inflated in like less than 4 minutes.
Yeah, with the machine.
Yeah. So the whole thing is a bag. It's like about the size of a very large carry-on.
And then did you buy actual paddles?
I didn't. That would be the one upgrade that I would do. It comes with paddles. They're perfectly serviceable, but
inflatable
if you bought
paddles?
No, they're they snap together. They come in four segments.
So they're little...
each paddle is four segments.
They don't work as hard as you'd like if you bought like really spent some money on some paddles.
I think if you spent more money on paddles, they'd probably just be more comfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe sturdier. I don't feel like mine are flimsy, but they're just, They would be more comfortable.
Yeah.
Any rigid kayak would be more comfortable than this. But given the fact that I'm not kayaking every weekend, this was a really good value. And I will pivot a little bit to the other subjects we wanted to talk about. I will not be upgrading to a hard-sided kayak because I did not win the Mega Millions billion-dollar lottery tonight.
Possibly nobody won. They still haven't. I don't know how. We'll ask Roger when he gets back. They still haven't announced. And he's like, well, they're checking the computers. And that makes no sense to me because you should instantly know we had a winner, we didn't have a winner. So I don't understand the delay on this. But they said if there is no winner tonight, it will be $1.6 billion, which will tie the all-time
record. I remember the last time this happened that we went about 3 hours before we actually got a notice from the lottery
officials. So you're promising me before we're out of here at 5 a.m. we're going to know?
I'm hoping to. Promising, I've been checking it. I've been refreshing the page like every 15, 20 minutes. And still, the winner results for the draw are still being compiled. Please check back later.
That was, but you know what, Matt? If I had $1 billion, what I couldn't do, I still couldn't afford to run for governor in Illinois.
That's not true. How much have they spent?
They have not crossed $1 billion yet, but
they haven't even crossed $100 million. They haven't even crossed $100 million.
But they are both multi-billionaire. Well, Rauner is not a billionaire.
I believe Rauner is a billionaire.
Oh, he is a billionaire.
I believe. We'll have to look that up.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they are both billionaires with a B.
Yeah.
So,
but low billions. They're not. Who is our richest man?
Jeff Bezos?
No, in Illinois.
Oh, he went through a huge divorce. Ken Griffin, the CEO of Citadel.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's in the 4 to 5 to 8 range, or maybe he was 4 when they got married and it was 8 when they were getting divorced, because I remember that was...
Oh, yeah.
We're following that story for a long time.
That was Illinois' own Days of Our Lives, like Dallas and Days of Our Lives all rolled into one.
We talked about that a lot on the radio. The stories about that divorce were fascinating.
Yeah. Rich people, man.
Yeah. Rich people problems. That's for sure. All right. We have to take a quick break. Can you hang out just a little bit longer? All right. Kim Bellware is with us at Bellwack on Twitter. Is a great follow. You can follow her latest story on Vice. They just go to Vice.com.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Vice.com and you can see her there as well as many other places. Just search Kim Bellware online and you'll find her. But at Bellwack on Twitter, BellWak. On Twitter, she's a great follow there. And hang out with us a little bit more, 720 WGM. More with Kim Bellwack after we check. You've just changed now. Now you're just Kim Bellwack. We've passed it. Kim Bellware after the news. Hear the sounds that matter. The top 5 at 5 from the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes weekday afternoons on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news is sponsored by VictoryAutoWreckers.com. VictoryAutoWreckers.com, Roger. This is a good Halloween song. Seasons of the Witch. This is the Mellow Yellow guy, Donovan.
Yeah.
I never heard you got to
pick up. This is like one of his most popular songs.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I'm guessing. Must be
the season of the week. Thank you very much. I'll be here if you need me.
Very good, Roger. Very impressive. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Our friend Kim Bellware still in studio with us, hanging out. You can follow her on Twitter at Bellwack with a K at the end. We've been talking inflatable rafts and the governor's race. And I don't know how those go together. Not inflatable rafts, inflatable kayaks.
It was what we could and couldn't afford if we won the Mega Millions.
Is that how we got on that?
And running for the governor is something you can't afford even with $1 million.
Not with $1 million, but with about $100 million. What are they going to, they've already combined to set a record for the most money spent on a governor's race in the country, I think. Not just in Illinois, right?
Because it was the Brown race, I think, in California that had the record before. I know that's the last state that had the record that Illinois was expected to break because.
So the state that's like more broke ass than any state in the U.S. more or less has 2 billionaires wasting a tenth of their fortunes to run for a job that pays what? Couple hundred thousand at most a year, right?
I think this is the narrative thread of tonight's show is, man, rich people.
I mean, it is kind of crazy to wonder why would you bother doing that? Forget that, because we're never going to figure that out. Let's jump to the Chicago mayor's race.
Another role that the question is, why do you want this job? Better answers for that one, but still.
I think much better answers for the city of Chicago.
But,
because here's why. In my mind, the state is, it's not your, it's your state. but you're such a part of wherever you live within a state. You know, I think it's hard to say, man, I love this state. Because
do people say that about Illinois?
I don't know if anybody says that about any state.
Oh, people in Michigan do.
California or Michigan. Okay. Well, Michigan is all kind of
weird.
No. I lived in Michigan for a year and I love Michigan. I love, you know, going there. And I lived in Detroit for a while. But I feel like Michigan is more like that's all one area.
Yeah.
It's a big area, but it's one really similar area. Whereas Illinois is, you have Chicago, you have these suburbs, you have everything south of I-80, and then the people south of I-80 say, that's not downstate, and then the outstate says, we're downstate. So it's really different areas.
One thing that I noticed about North Carolina, where there was a really strong sense of state pride and just cohesion of what people think about, not to say that everybody has the same idea,
sure,
but all of the major cities are along the same highway, east to west, from Asheville to New Bern. I think those are on opposite sides of the state. My North Carolina geography is admittedly poor, but whatever direction I hit every major city in, you know, Raleigh-Durham, New Bern, Asheville, Chapel Hill, you know, all that.
Is there also a river that runs along that road? Yeah, I mean, you imagine the way the cities got big in the first place.
Yeah.
There's probably waterways or some
I don't know, but I feel like, I feel like all of the cities being on this continuous east-west highway, because it makes it so easy to travel back and forth. People seem to have a lot of experience being in these other cities, where I grew up in Michigan on the southwest side of the state. Upper Peninsula may as well be a different country to us in a lot of respects. And we were felt very different from Detroit, you know, from the Detroit area. You know, we would maybe rep the sports teams, but.
But from the Detroit area, don't you still have a respect and a love for the UP? No?
I don't know. I never grew up there, so I couldn't say, but we just felt that they were so. We embraced them as Michiganders, but they were very different. They are very different.
Yeah.
If you've ever met a Youper, you know, it's
I have friends that go up there that have, you know, cottages up there, and they go to the UP in the summers.
Canada,
like
Northern Wisconsin, and Fargo all rolled into one.
And pasties,
yeah.
Which I was very confused by at first. What is a pasty? I don't even remember. It's sort of like a little pocket.
Hot pocket type thing, right? It's like a little hot pie kind of thing.
Yeah. But I think Illinois, maybe because it's such a long state that we're so separated from each other, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like in Wisconsin or in Michigan, people, you know, the UP, oh yeah, we love the UP. Nobody's going, oh, downstate, I love downstate. You know, there's no like draw to like, or not that we don't like anybody in different parts of Illinois, but we're not like, oh yeah, I love going down to Carbondale. It's this.
I kind of like that one gubernatorial candidate who wanted to break the state up into three pieces. I'm like, that actually kind of makes sense.
It would make sense, except everybody, you know,
it's a terrible
that out,
right? idea that does make a lot of sense in some respects. Well, then you also look at this is something that Senator Dick Durbin is fond of saying, something like, the southernmost, in some parts of Illinois, you are closer to Arkansas than you are to Chicago.
I'm sure.
Was, you know, his thing to discuss how, you know, diverse
different
the state
the
is. You know, Illinois, in like the very broad sense, you know, is considered a blue state just because our major population center, you know, leans, you know, always goes reliably blue.
Yeah.
But that is, if you said Illinois is a blue state, it really just glosses over all of the complexities of.
Well, when you see those maps of the U.S. and they do the county by county, red
then
and blue,
and
there's just like four dots of blue across the country, like, whoa.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people packed into those little areas.
Right. And, you know, when you think about in the part of southern Illinois, it's really close to St. Louis. You know, they're closer to Missouri. They're closer to Louisville. Chicago feels very far away, and probably culturally, you know, values wise, just very different too from them. So I understand the disconnect. Illinois is it's an interesting state that way. I think we've got an interesting thing going on. But why you want to be governor of that versus why you want to be just focus on Chicago? I mean,
or just focus on philanthropy or something. I think that you could do so much more good with your money then you're probably going to do running a state. And it makes me almost question, what is your reason for wanting to run this? I have a hard time believing that, well, I have all this money, now I want to give back. I really think I can. It just doesn't feel, I don't know.
I and think maybe it's because they terrible can. And cynical. You know, like, what are you going to do? You don't need to work to make money. You have already, what is your mark going to be? I mean, is this a legacy? Okay. Is this an ego thing?
Okay, so if it's that, why not run for Senate? Don't you feel like that has more cachet and you're on a national stage but still representing your state and there might be more really, you know, the committees you could be on and all those, to me,
I think Senate
that would be much sexier than being governor.
But I think Senate has always been more of a competitive job than, I mean, depending on what state, you know, it's still,
sure.
Senate is still the most prestigious role in, I think, in government apart from president. What used to be a prestigious role.
I think that sounds right. Absolutely. But within a state, there's two of them. I mean, you're still running just against whoever's living in that state. And I don't know. I think that, so we've got Senator Durbin that's been there forever. Tammy Duckworth just got in not that long ago. I think it's not like a state where you go, well, it's impossible to ever get elected there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, Durbin's there until he decides not to be. It seems like he'd have trouble getting knocking him out. And Senator Duckworth, I would assume, will be the same way for a while. But I would think a few years ago, you could have ran when Tammy Duckworth was running. You could have jumped into that race.
Yeah.
And with $60 million, had a pretty good shot.
I think of it as, you know, maybe depending on running for governor of a place like Illinois or California, Texas, kind of a different beast. But, you know, if you have the choice of being the governor of a state like Rhode Island versus being a senator, where even though you represent a tiny state, you can be very influential in national politics.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I think the office of governor is a lot less exciting and powerful. And I think we were talking off air about, depending on what the makeup is of your House Speaker, your Attorney General, maybe big city mayors that you have to contend with. I mean, look at how much Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio go at it in New York.
Yeah.
You know, the mayor of New York City versus the governor of the state. They really have to kind of dance with one another in states where if you don't have a major metro area, that mayor might not be as big of a headache. But
I think it's kind of the same way here in Illinois.
Oh, yeah. Mayor of Chicago is completely, you know, could be your best friend or the biggest pain in your side.
Yeah, outside of Mike Madigan. All right, so let's jump to the mayor of Chicago real quick, because there are how many people running now? By your count?
It's upwards of 18, I think.
Is it? Oh, my God.
Maybe. It's upwards of 12 for sure.
Yes.
I think 18.
I think you're right. I would go with at least 15. Chicago, I'd meet you halfway there.
Chicago Magazine is tracking and doing their own kind of power rankings, who's up, who's down this week.
Right.
And I think last week the count was, I think it was 18, because they're counting everybody who is declared, including the candidates, like the perennial candidates that never get any press coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So they're counting everybody who is, you know, officially.
Who's officially out there. So Chance the Rapper came out this week and endorsed somebody who I know there's a lot of names, but somebody who wasn't even on my radar, and I can't remember her name.
Amara Enya.
Amara, okay.
Yes.
And she, and as I'm reading about her then because of this, is a very interesting background and very interesting thing she's been doing. She is currently, I don't know. She holds a position right now, right?
She is a lawyer. She's an attorney. And she works, I'm blanking on this, I just was looking over her bio.
I thought she had an elected position. She doesn't, because she's done some really interesting work.
She's done quite a few things, and I can't believe I'm blanking on this because it's maybe too late at night for me to remember. But my colleagues covered her when the last mayor election, because she ran against Rahm and then ended up dropping out to back Bob Fioretti.
Mm.
But we figured we would see her again, and we did. I mean, she's rather young. She is the daughter of, I think, Nigerian immigrants. Law degree, has a lot of experience. You're right. I think she does have a health role, some kind of maybe Cook County health role.
Yeah, that sounds right.
We'll get this confirmed for listeners. But I was not surprised that that is who he backed. I thought all of the talk about people saying, you know, Chance the mayor, I think that's stupid. I think that stuff is ridiculous. And given the stuff that he has been promoting, it was either going to be a voter drive or an endorsement. And it turned out to be an endorsement, which is, you know, certainly interesting. I think, you know, in Chicago Magazine, they talked about his endorsement being a big deal. I really don't know. I mean, I don't know if it is. He is undeniably probably the most influential Chicago celebrity for the youth vote, which is historically a demographic that does not turn out.
Right.
But if they did, that would be
change things.
It would be a huge turning of the tide. I mean, these younger voters who do lean towards these more sort of insurgent candidates, a lot, you know, further left, maybe more progressive on that spectrum, in the vein of, you know, the Carlos Ramirez Rosas, you know, Democratic Socialist, that kind of thing. If they all showed up, they could get the candidates. I mean, in some ways, we do have absolutely representative government, because who votes a lot? Older people, older white people. And that's why we have older white people in our government.
Yeah.
So if he is able to marshal that attention and really get people to the polling places in November, then that could absolutely have a big impact. Well, I guess for the Chicago mayor elections, we're talking about the in March. March. Or is it February? It's March. Whatever the reason,
why do I think it's in February?
There's absolutely no reason for Chicago's municipal elections to not be the same time as the federal elections.
Well, that must have been done by a mayor who didn't want too many people voting, right?
Yeah, who wants to show up in Chicago in the middle of winter to vote.
Yeah, it's a way to keep things down. Do you think that Chance will stay with this, that he'll actively, now that he's endorsed somebody, will he actively? Because it's one thing to say, yeah, well, all these people follow me, I'm going to get out the vote, but it really is a more of a ground game thing. You have to stay with it and really encourage them and have rallies and things, get people registered. It's not just, hey, by the way, go vote, and then people go vote. I mean, we saw that with Taylor Swift came out politically.
Yeah.
Like 65,000 people registered to vote the next day in her state, which really could change things. But will Chance, in your mind, do the work that really needs to happen to get the young people to vote? Because people might get interested or excited or whatever, but if they don't register, if they don't take the time, if they don't actually go vote, which historically younger people don't do, it's not going to make a difference at all.
If Chance's interest is, I think his interest in doing good for the youth of Chicago is sincere and, you know, has been sustained in different ways.
He certainly donated a lot of money and done a lot of work towards that.
And, you know, that's no small thing, but it is relatively easier to cut checks and, you know, make cute ads and promos and show up for pressers than it is to do. I mean, the big thing that I gave kind of hammered him about is when he announced that he was buying Chicagoist. He hasn't done anything with that. You know, he talked a big game about how the city needed this outlet to be independent, to be representative of the voices that are not often heard from or covered fairly or kind of accurately or charitably in Chicago media. And he hasn't done anything with it yet. He's obviously very busy, and maybe that wasn't a high priority, but the mayor's race has a timer on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think he's a busy guy that has a lot of ideas and wants to do a lot of things. Does he have the discipline and does he have the plan to, I mean, he said that he, you know, wasn't sure about what was going to happen money wise, because right now, if she's going to stay in the race to a runoff, what she's going to need is money. And he certainly has money himself that he could donate. I don't think it's necessarily fair to expect that he's going to, you know, single-handedly.
No, but he made an interesting comment when he was asked about that. He said, well, I haven't cut a check yet, but I don't know. We'll see. I have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Which was weird to say.
Kind of a weird boast.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we get it, man. We do have a lot of money.
But I wouldn't think he has, I don't know how much he's sold, but Chance is kind of our star, and I know he's national, but he's not Oprah.
Yeah.
You know, he's not, I can't imagine he's got even $50 or $25 million.
I think the last he was valued by Forbes, and this was really based on, I mean, they are pulling this together by all lot of speculative things, I think it was around $10 million.
Yeah.
It's probably surpassed that. I mean,
which is a crazy amount to you and I, but to a entertainment celebrity who's being asked probably to donate, you know, he's raised millions of dollars for the city and for youth. So it's not like he's got a lot that he would probably feel comfortable writing out of his pocket.
But he also owns all of his work. You know, he never signed with a label. He controls all of his, I mean, his team, I think they're his people. So he's not losing a lot of money by signing with, I think, a big agency or, you know, a talent group. And, you know, he tours. He has a lot of endorsements, you know, Kit Kat, Lyft, you know, different things like that. He sells a lot of merchandise. I mean, I think you see his hats everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a good, certainly a good businessman. So, you know, I don't know. And who knows what other things are going on. My mom told me it was rude to count other people's money, but she didn't think I was going to become a reporter.
That's true. Not if you're a reporter, Mom, then I have to ask these questions. That leads me back to, we'll go back to right where it all started before I let you go. We're talking about the lottery at the beginning, and we talked about wanting to stay anonymous. And I was telling you that I've read, I believe it's only five states where you legally can stay anonymous, and I don't know what the regulations are, if you have to be at a press conference or how they release the money to you. But we talked about wanting to stay anonymous. And I said, well, as a journalist, you would have to be filing the request to, like, try to find out the name, right? And you said that you think that maybe it would be bad karma and you'd back off of that assignment.
I mean, you know, maybe this is bad journalist instincts on my part, but I don't know that it interests me unless that person did something extraordinary with the money.
But I agree that would be interesting, but just the way it would change somebody's life would be interesting to hear about. She's a teacher, she's, you know, she's this or he's that, and, you know, how is this going to change your lives? What if they were already a millionaire and they'd be like, God, that's a waste, why did they win it? But if they were like, you know, I got all these bills and this is going to change everything, then to follow, like, because it'd just be so interesting to see somebody just be handed that. How are they going to react and what are they going to do? And is it going to actually improve their lives? Or 5 years from now, are they going to say, I wish I never bought that ticket?
I think if I knew more about personal finance and taxes and things like that, it would maybe make my brain a little more curious. But for now, I just think of all these miserable looking people on the Illinois Lottery website holding their big checks who clearly do not want to have their picture taken.
Yeah.
And I just think, I'm sorry. Like, I'm sure you're going to have every single person that's ever, you know, gave you a stick of gum who's going to come back and ask you for a favor, fund their idea, help their, you know, Kickstarter, you know, anything in the world. And I just think that would make me want to never leave my newly fortified home.
Well, that would be such the sad thing about it, wouldn't it? Is that, like, however much you didn't want it to, it would change your life in ways you didn't want. Yes, you could do anything you want. You'd have all this freedom. But everybody you know and everybody that you love, you'd probably sort of look at a little bit differently. Even though they didn't necessarily do anything, your life is the one that changed. But now you'd have this guard up.
Something that I always wondered about rich people, and I mostly wondered it in the context of celebrities who try to live among the rest of us. You know, if you live in a neighborhood in LA and not the Hollywood Hills, or if you live in, you know, you live in Manhattan in New York and you're recognizable as a extremely wealthy celebrity and you are trying to just be a normal person and go, like, get coffee and read at a coffee shop. Are you expected to give these, like, ridiculous tips? Because do you remember when a couple years ago, like maybe 5 years ago, where there were all these big movies being filmed in Chicago?
Yeah.
You know, like Johnny Depp and Christian Bale.
And they'd report on the tips that everybody was giving.
You could hear who was a good tipper and who wasn't. Heath Ledger was a great tipper. Christian Bale was a great tipper. I mean, of course that gets out. People in the service industry talk. Maybe high-end places, they're going to try and be discreet and they're going to discourage their staff from doing that. But the whisper network of people, you know, if you just tip the customary 20% or, you know, you tip a dollar or two on a latte at a coffee shop, that's like a good tip.
Yeah.
But if you come in your Taylor Swift, are they going to be like, wow, she's cheap?
Yeah.
You know, she didn't drop a 50 in the bucket.
I think you would have a lot of pressure to tip like 30% wherever you go, pretty much. What you'd feel like, oh, they know who I am. I probably, and I think you'd have to, what you should do is think of it as, I get so much for free. Because I imagine a celebrity, now you're rich,
point.
But you're still getting things for free all the time. So just be a little more generous with the people who are still struggling. And I think what would really be tough is when you get really crappy service and you're like, I would never give 20% right now. This was awful. They weren't paying attention. They didn't care, blah, blah, blah. And then you'd be like, but I, now, the report is going to be what a jerk, you know, when we see the reports of somebody who is really cheap.
The in touch story about, you know,
and you wonder,
no Tip,
like,
and Pippin.
Yeah. Was that person really bad? Or like, were they like, oh my God, they spilled three drinks on me and they brought the wrong dinner and it was cold and it had a fly in it.
Now I
and
have
so
a,
that's what I did.
I have a lot of friends in the service industry, some who have worked at, you know, really fancy places in Chicago, bars and restaurants and that kind of thing. And they said that, you know, I don't know what the perception is of how extremely wealthy people tip, but a lot of them say it, what to me was a surprising number, but maybe it shouldn't be, is that a lot of really wealthy people, not only are they terrible tippers, they're terrible because they don't tip at all. And it's because they think maybe, like in the most charitable explanation, maybe they just don't realize that this is part of what a server's salary, you know, how that gets
so
made up.
So they grew up completely rich and like,
well,
this sounds like
point.
George Bush not knowing how the scanners work at the, at the grocery store. I mean,
Or maybe they
terrible.
Think someone else is taking care of it. I don't know. I mean, ugh. Just nothing? I mean, that was what dogged Scotty. Isn't that like why Scotty Pippen doesn't go
was
out in Chicago?
Scotty Pippen? Was he a bad tipper? Was that the
Well, his nickname was No Tippin' Pippen. I think it was not that he didn't. Someone, I'll have to ask my my friend Ricky O'Donnell, who is a writer for SB Nation and covers the Bulls, who would know. Or, you know, listeners can call in and tell you, did Scotty Pippen get that nickname because he was a bad tipper, or was it because he was a non-tipper? I mean, No Tippin' Pippin rolls off the tongue
that's
a lot.
That's a great name.
A lot easier than Low Tip. Well, actually, Low Tippin' Pippin is pretty good.
No Tippin' Pippin, or are you Low Tippin' Pippin?
I mean, maybe, wow. Maybe Scotty Pippin just stiffed every single.
Yeah, well, Scotty's famously had financial problems. He made insane amounts of money and then I think was suing people because he was broke.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I thought it was Dennis Rodman.
Probably too. But I know Scotty definitely had, I don't know if it was bad investments or like somebody swindled him or what happened or a bad divorce or maybe a combination of everything.
Free story idea. I would be interested in seeing a graph of like how many NBA players by year have, you know, filed for personal bankruptcy or something like that. Because I have heard so many times about these financial courses that freshman players in the NBA are given, which I don't think they were doing in the, you know, in the 80s and the 90s when, you know, guys like Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen were coming up. But they definitely do that now where they're trying to, some of it is just to prevent these guys from being broke by the time they're, you know, 30.
And I think, I wonder in the NFL, it'd be even more pervasive because they're such short careers.
Oh, yeah.
They sign one big contract and you have
What's
your hangers
average-
on. NFL
3 years?
Like 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. Maybe.
And most of the, a lot of those guys, you know, they're such big teams. A lot of those guys are making $600,000 or $1 million a year. Only a few guys are making the $10, $20 million contracts.
Well, so a friend of mine.
In the NBA, the worst players are still making $10 million
right.
a year. It's crazy.
I mean, a friend of mine from high school was a very successful NFL player for the Packers, Greg Jennings.
Okay.
And he retired at 33. And I was like, that's cool.
Oh, can you imagine?
Can you imagine? I would. I cannot because I am no longer 33 and I am nowhere close to retirement.
And never going to be.
We really picked the wrong. We should, Matt, we should have gone.
We should have been 6'4" and very athletic. We really
should have been in the NBA. I mean, I would have been in the WNBA, so I would have been making like 1/10 of what you would be making. But
that's true.
Funny you guys should ask.
Did somebody win?
No. Oh. No, but I decided to look because I'm a curious person. 15 NBA players who went broke after retiring. And this is from June of 2017. So the 15 players, Sean Kemp. He
had like 8 children with 8 different women.
$91 million total career earnings. Led the Supersonics to the first NBA Finals appearance in 2 decades. Number 14, Darius Miles, $62 million career earnings. Eric Williams, these are a couple of guys I don't remember, $39.8 million. David Harrison, $4.4 million. That's easy to go broke.
Yeah, I could blow that.
Yeah. Why did that jump from... Oh, okay, never mind. Derek Coleman, the writer wrote, Sports Illustrated once wrote of Derek Coleman that he played just well enough to ensure his next paycheck. $91 million total career earnings. Kenny Anderson.
Can you imagine going bankrupt if you made $91 million?
Yeah, isn't that something?
And I guess, you know, when you don't have money and you suddenly come into money, you probably think, as an athlete or superstar, with everybody just blowing smoke up your rear, that this will always be here, that I'll always make more, that it's okay, or thinking that people are taking care of you. By the way, Kim 708 texted Pippen. He was a no tipper. What a wad.
Wow. Oh, not a lot of money.
No.
Eddie Curry, $70 million. He went broke Wonderful. After he retired. Jason Caffey, Antoine Walker, Latrell Sprewell. Remember Walker, him?
Former Mount Carmel.
Yeah, $97 million.
Latrell Sprewell, who choked his coach.
Yep.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Dennis Rodman, number four on the list. Total career earnings, $26.9 million. You would think
that's
he...
That's all he made?
That's apparently...
Wow. Well, I guess he played in the 80s. And
court documents filed by the lawyer of the of Dennis Rodman, 2014, acknowledged that he was extremely sick and broke, making it impossible for him to fulfill his required child support commitments. At the time, he owed $808,000 in back child support. And number three, Scottie Pippen.
There we go.
$109 million total career earnings. Let's see here. He still wasn't Exhibit A. He once bought a $4 million jet that didn't even work. he then not so wisely invested another million into the jet in an attempt to fix it. It ended up being a $5 million showpiece. Wow. Up until recently, he was stabilized and even thriving financially, but in recent months, this again is over a year ago, he and his wife have been battling in court over the estate as they finalize their divorce. Vin Baker, number two, and Allen Iverson, number one.
Wow, and he went bankrupt.
$154 million.
Huh.
And now you know. That's one to grow on.
There you go.
All right, we have to say goodbye to Kim. Thank you so much for staying up late with us. We really appreciate it. Follow Kim at Bellwack, B-E-L-L-W-A-K, on Twitter, and look for her. Where's the next piece we should look for?
I think Chicago Magazine.
Chicago Magazine, out now or coming up?
Out now.
Out now. Look for Chicago Magazine on your newsstands. It's getting late. Let's do some news headlines, Mr. Badish. Yeah.